Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Emily, and I'll be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes in the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $300,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is Beyond the Pros and Cons, Legal, Political, and Social Perspectives on Same-Sex Marriage in Utah. And now I'd like to introduce Tilly McInnes, who will be moderating today's forum.
Thank you for that introduction. Hello. Okay, so thank you again for coming to this event, which was sponsored by the Student Advisory Committee for the Political Science Department. We're absolutely thrilled that you came and about our wonderful panelists. Our three panelists today are Professor Clement, who is from the History Department and Gender Studies, Professor Myers, who is from the Political Science Department and Gender Studies, and Professor Levin, who's in the Political Science Department but teaches a lot of law and politics. So the order of the panelists speaking today will be Professor Levin, Professor Clement, Professor Levin, Professor Myers. I was looking at you and I thought maybe you'd go this direction, but I was wrong. So that's the order, and they'll be coming up to the podium to present for roughly 10 minutes, and then after they present, all three of them, we'll open up for Q&A, and we'll go from there. You'll each get a one-minute warning from me, but I'm sitting over there. So let's get started with Professor Clement.
Since I'm the historian on this panel, I'm going to provide the historical context for basically two issues. One is the role that marriage has played in the U.S., particularly as a way of distributing benefits to citizens. And then I am also going to be discussing why it was that gays and lesbians began to see marriage as a goal for the LGBT movement. And these remarks are actually based on remarks that I made a while ago that were much longer, so any questions that you have about varieties of issues, particularly the current case and a lot of the, you know, the social science data that is being used or deployed in that case, please feel free to raise that in the questions and answers. In the United States, it is actually states who have traditionally regulated marriage. But beginning with the New Deal, the federal government began to offer benefits for people whose families fit particular patterns, namely married male breadwinner, female homemaker families. And I don't have time to discuss these benefits in detail today, but suffice it to say that these benefits are both legal and financial, and they are extensive. Unlike most Western democracies, which base benefits on citizenship, our federal government has chosen to tie our social welfare benefits to either work or marriage. This unnecessarily increases the value and importance of marriage because it makes marriage a major conduit for the benefits that the state bestows upon us. Historically, Americans have positioned gays and lesbians as outside of family and at times as dangerous to family. However, through the 1950s and 1960s, many gay people still had children. Most people who experienced same-sex desires in this period usually married, some because they wanted the social acceptance of marriage and some because they wanted to be parents and could think of no other way to do so. As a result, gay experiences of parenting are actually much longer or have a much longer history than most Americans are aware of. From the 1950s through the 1990s, however, the state, through the family courts, actively sought to prevent gays from having custody or even visitation of their children in the event of a divorce. When they took children from queer parents, the courts reflected societal beliefs that gays existed outside of family, could not form, were incapable of forming stable family ties, and were a danger to children. The fear was that gay people raising children would either sexually abuse these children, conflating homosexuality with pedophilia, or would, through their example, somehow turn their children gay? And as many of you undoubtedly know, there is no actual correlation between pedophilia and homosexuality. The vast majority of pedophiles identify as heterosexual men. So this is a myth. But it was a myth that was believed by many, many Americans and that was enshrined in certain kinds of legal practices in the United States. So as it turns out, these fears were unfounded. We now have 40 years of social science data on lesbian families. We have more data on lesbian families than on gay male families because lesbian family formation began in the late 1970s, whereas gay men's baby boom has started much later than that. So we have a lot of data on these families. And this data indicates that children raised in lesbian families fare as well as those raised in straight ones and that they are no more likely to turn out gay. Even though there's no difference between children raised in lesbian families in terms of social adjustment or sexual identity, there are small differences between them and their peers raised in straight families that I think are quite interesting. My favorite one of these is that children raised in lesbian families turn out to be more tolerant than their straight-raised peers, particularly of gender nonconformity. But that's a difference that, as a feminist, I'm willing to celebrate. For feminists, or really anyone who's interested in social justice, more tolerant children is a win. When is intolerance ever good for anybody? However, the assumption behind these studies that gay parents might produce gay children does raise the question, would more gay people really be such a bad thing? And here I'm channeling queer theorist Eve Sedgwick, may she rest in peace. There are straight people, simply by virtue of their sexual orientation, really better than queer people? Are they better citizens? Do they perform the duties of citizenship in a significantly better way? Does the state really, at this point in time, have a legitimate interest in the sexual orientation of our citizens? As a result of state and community hostility to gay parenting from the 1950s through the 1980s, any queer parent who wanted to maintain relationships with their children had to lie about their sexuality, hide their identity, and often abstain from forming stable partnerships. And the reason they had to do this was that courts often made this a requirement of custody or visitation. So if you're going to maintain custody or visitation, courts often said you may not expose your children to gay culture, to gay people, or to gay relationships. In essence, gays and lesbians had to choose between one kind of family relationship, that of a loving commitment to a partner, and another, the relationship between parents and children. Unlike straight married couple, queer people could not form loving partnerships and be loving parents at the same time. So gays and lesbians have had kids for a long time, and those kids do as well as children raised in straight families on all the markers of social and sexual adjustment. Interest in marriage in the gay community, however, has been varied, and it's only recently that marriage has become a priority for the LGBT movement. Gay liberation began in a riot at the Stonewall Inn in New York City in 1969, and gay liberation did not initially support marriage as a goal. Viewing marriage as a patriarchal institution that oppressed women and children and reinforced negative gender roles, most gay liberationists actively rejected marriage. Instead, they applied liberation both to sexual identity and to family structure. All people, gay liberationists insisted, should free their sexuality from the strictures of heterosexism and sexism. All people should be free to pursue healthy adult sexuality in whatever way they sought fit, and should actively attempt to eliminate oppressive understandings of what it meant to be a man or a woman from their lives and from their identities. Finally, gay liberationists argued that families should no longer interfere in the sexuality of children in their desire to promote and enforce heterosexuality. Children, gay liberationists believe, should have the right to determine their own sexuality. So instead of reifying homosexuality, gay liberationists actually hoped that the categories of gay and straight and male and female would eventually disappear, and we would all be free to be who we were and to choose to love who we wanted. But if gay liberation fundamentally disapproved of marriage as an oppressive institution that promoted unhealthy sexual roles, how and why did the LGBT movement come to embrace marriage as a goal? Which is to say, what changed their mind? In the 1970s, gays and lesbians could largely ignore marriage. But by the 1980s, the AIDS epidemic and the lesbian baby boom brought home the fact that all of us need to be recognized as families on the borders of life and death. Routinely, partners of gay men dying of AIDS lacked any legal right to make medical or caregiving decisions for their partners. They also lacked inheritance rights and thus often lost not only their partners but their homes when, in the absence of state recognition for their relationships, these properties passed to straight kin. AIDS produced a devastating crisis in gay families at exactly the moment of illness and death when people are most vulnerable and felt the least able to cope. The lesbian baby boom raised similar questions, although generally in the more positive situation of birth. Non-biological mothers could not make medical decisions for their partners or unborn children, could not provide health insurance benefits or other benefits for their children, nor could they access parental leave to care for their children. Even more devastating, non-biological mothers lacked legal rights to the children they raised, and in the case of breakup, often lost custody or visitation of children that they had parented for years. Furthermore, in cases where the biological mother died, her straight kin often sued and won custody of children, removing already grieving children from the only family they had ever known. This often happened over the express wishes of the children themselves. In one case I found from the early 1980s, after the death of the biological mother, the grandparents won custody of their granddaughter, Kristen, removing her from the care of her non-biological mother, Janine. Kristen made her desire to stay with Janine very clear to the judge, stating in a court interview, quote, "For Christmas, I don't really want a present. All I want is to live with her. That's my Christmas present." After Christmas had passed, Kristen again appealed to the judge, writing, "Dear Mr. Scoot, Merry Christmas. Love, Kristen. P.S. Try your hardest to get me back with my mom before my birthday, January 31st. After several years of Kristen's increasingly articulate demands that she be returned to her mother, the judge finally transferred custody back to Janine. Thus, by the late 1980s, it was clear that the lack of family rights seriously disadvantaged queer families, making our already difficult lives unbearably painful and frightening. Given the state's linking of various legal and economic rights to marriage, the LGBT community had very little choice but to pursue marriage as a solution to our now very pressing family problems. Marriage became a goal precisely because it offers one-stop shopping. It would reverse the legal and financial disadvantages we faced in forming our families and in protecting the family bonds that we had already made. But even as the gay community came around to marriage, marriage itself had changed in ways that made gay marriage easier for most Americans to imagine. Which is to say, gays and lesbians needed to change their position towards marriage, but marriage itself had also changed in ways that made gay marriage more culturally intelligible to more of us than it had ever done before. And there are several reasons for this. The first is that ideas of choice and consent have always been an important part of Christian understandings of marriage. However, not everyone has always had that right in the United States. Slaves could not marry before the law, and after the Civil War, many states passed laws banning interracial marriage. Over the course of the 20th century, however, legal restrictions on marital choice largely disappeared. The most ringing endorsement of this change came in 1967 with the Supreme Court case Loving v. Virginia, which eliminated bans on interracial marriage. As the court stated in Loving, quote, "The freedom to marry has long been recognized as one of the vital personal rights essential to the orderly pursuit of happiness by free men. Marriage is one of the basic civil rights of man." Another big change in marriage has been the decreasing importance of gender in structuring the roles that and the rights and responsibilities of husbands and wives. Under common law, marriage in the colonial period involved a woman losing all of her legal claim to her own legal identity. The law of domestic relations ensured that married women could not sue or be sued, could not own or will property, could not own her own wages or enter into contracts. Spurred by the first women's rights movement that emerged in Seneca Falls in 1848, legal developments in the 19th century gradually changed these definitions, giving women more property and custody rights, and in 1920, the right to vote. But it wasn't really until the 1970s that feminism that the last vestiges of coverture were swept away. For example, before the emergence of feminism, the law defined women and men's responsibilities in marriage differently. Before the 1970s, men had a legal obligation to financially support their wives, but not vice versa. This has now become a mutual obligation. Women and men may still play distinct and traditionally gendered roles in marriages should they choose to do so, but they are no longer legally required to do so. The law no longer views the responsibilities of husbands and wives as different and instead sees them as virtually identical. Yes, I know. Finally, although ideas about marriage and religion have often intertwined, the idea that marriage is primarily a religious matter has never been true in the U.S. First of all, most marriages in the colonial period were usually performed by civic rather than religious authorities. Second, and to me more importantly, since many denominations allow gay marriage and many ban it, arguing that religion forbids the state from allowing gay marriage privileges one set of religious beliefs and denominations over another. Who is to say that before the law we must listen to the Catholics and the Mormons and not the Reformed Jews and the Unitarians? Using a religious justification for banning gay marriage is a violation of the separation between church and state because it privileges the views and policies of some religions over others. In this context, this isn't really a gay rights issue. It's whether the state can choose between different competing religious values and ideas. LGBT people have come to need marriage because of the way the state has used marriage to provide legal and economic benefits and rights. And marriage itself has changed enough, particularly through its increasingly egalitarian nature, to make gay marriage imaginable. While I would like to see the state separate benefits for families from marriage, that seems unlikely to happen. As a result, gay marriage is a necessary development in the equality of LGBT citizens and our families before the law. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to do the legal part of this and talk a little bit about the Kitchen case, but also what has led up to Kitchen and a little bit try to prognosticate just a very small bit about what may follow because I know better than to predict the future. If I was better at predicting the future, I might still have a live bracket. Or I might be Warren Buffett myself. So, I want to talk a little bit about the rapid rise of same-sex marriage in the United States, and it has been a very rapid rise for something which was not even on anybody's radar really before 1994, and which was not an actuality in any of the states before 2003. It's had a very rapid rise, and I think it's important to understand that. It's now legal in 17 states and the District of Columbia. It has been since the Kitchen decision in December 20th of last year, we now have 5 federal district court decisions that have removed bans in different states. The most recent, of course, last Friday in Michigan. And so that has been a very rapid movement in federal courts, which are not known for moving rapidly. If anything moves slowly, it is the law, and especially federal courts. And especially on social issues, which is not something they like to meddle with. It is not their favored medium for movement. And we also have a number of other cases where we have state actors, state attorney generals, who have decided that they are willing to essentially step aside as this movement occurs through the courts. We have state attorney generals in states with active cases such as Pennsylvania and Nevada who have decided that they will no longer contest actions against their state bans. And so we're going to see continued action there as well. So I want to talk about what's happened, especially in the last year, that has led to the Kitchen case and which is going to continue to affect these cases in the future. I want to start with really the two most recent Supreme Court cases, which were decided last June, the end of last June, in particular the Windsor case, but also just a few very quick words on the Hollingsworth versus Perry case. United States versus Windsor is the case that was in many ways most essential to the Kitchen case. That's the, of course, Kitchen versus Herbert, I've mentioned it a few times, is the Utah same-sex marriage ban case. Windsor was an estate tax case. It involved a lesbian couple who had been married in Canada. They were resident in the state of New York. New York did not at that time recognize, it recognized same-sex marriage from foreign jurisdictions, meaning jurisdictions outside of New York, other states as well as, in this case, Canada. But it had not yet adopted same-sex marriage in New York State. Windsor's spouse had passed. She had a considerable estate tax bill, both at the state level, which was waived in New York, but at the federal level, because the IRS did not recognize her marriage as legitimate because of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, she was hit with an estate tax bill of $363,000. $363,000 off of what was a several million dollar estate. And I know you're all thinking we should all have such problems. But it was not money she cared to part with, of course. And the Supreme Court is going to reverse DOMA, as the Defense of Marriage Act is generally known. And they do so for some very simple reasons, and they become highly relevant in the district court cases that we've had since. They find, most importantly, that DOMA was adopted out of hostility towards the gay community. And that's the finding that becomes most relevant, that was not part of the legal puzzle before. That it is this sense of antagonism that gets added. They also find that DOMA was a violation of both the Equal Protection and Due Process Clauses of the Constitution, of the 14th Amendment. And those findings were something that had been part of the puzzle before, but it gets articulated here. And they find that, moreover, it violates what is called the rational basis standard of review. That's actually the lowest level of scrutiny that a court gives to a law. It's the lowest level of protection. But to fail it, a law simply has to lack any legitimate basis. It has to simply not be relevant. And if you can't show a legitimate purpose for a government acting in such a way, well, you're doing a pretty awful job. So that's an important part of this. Now, the second decision was kind of a decision that fell flat in terms of people's expectations. It's the Hollingworth decision, and it was actually an appeal from a district court decision in California, where a federal district court had invalidated a California initiative, Prop 8. I'm sure a lot of you remember all the excitement over Prop 8, which had reinstated a state ban, constitutional ban, on same-sex marriage. And that there's a reason why we, I will generally refer to Kitchen v. Herbert as the first federal court decision where you have federal law striking down a state ban. And that's because Prop 8 was actually, and the Perry decision in California, was actually a very complex mix of federal and state law, because the California State Supreme Court had previously struck down California's same-sex marriage ban. And the procedural history of Prop 8 and the California same-sex marriage ban is a mess. It's the kind of disaster that only really strikes California. A place where, you know, your average disaster movie is most likely to take place. And not just because it's easier to cast. And so the Supreme Court in that case basically avoids all the constitutional issues except for the standing issue, and they get rid of it. So there's no Supreme Court precedent in that case, but it gives the federal district courts a sense that there's some room for them to work within. It sort of liberates them a bit, gives them a sense of some availability of space to maneuver. Now, the Utah case is, of course, the most interesting one for us. And I'm going to urge you all to have a chance to take a chance and read it. I'm not going to promise you anything exciting to read. I will say that you reading it is going to be more interesting to you than me reading it to you, because I know it's noontime and some of you may have had lunch already, and that will just cause you all to drop off and miss Ella's talk. I will tell you this. It is worth reading because what it does well is it is a good example of what federal district court judges do. They solve problems. They look at the kinds of privileges and benefits that go with marriage, the kinds of concrete issues that are really tied to the marital institution, that go to specific benefits, privileges, monetary rewards, monetary penalties, that go to child rearing, and that go to the incentives that create and maintain stable relationships over time. Shelby's opinion, Judge Shelby was an Obama appointee relatively recently to the bench, is an example of judicial problem solving. There's relatively little highfalutin rhetoric, and that's actually a good thing in this case. There's some, but what he does is he builds on what comes out of Windsor. He focuses on the animus that animated the campaign for Amendment 3 as Utah's constitutional amendment that prohibits such same-sex marriage was called. I'm being signaled. She's either bidding on an artwork or I'm being signaled. He focuses on the equal protection issues and how we're talking about marital rights which already exist for heterosexual couples that are being denied to homosexual couples. He focuses on the due process issues about the reasonability of the law and whether there are good reasons to believe that homosexual couples raise children in ways that disadvantage those children or not, and finds a lack of good social science evidence that this makes a difference, that the differences really lie in terms of the stability of family relationships instead. And notes the degree to which federal precedent says that, in fact, we should be looking at how we support those families that do exist and not looking for reasons to believe that, in fact, the laws will deter the formation of such families. And so what we see in the Kitchen case is that kind of fact-based, problem-solving approach, which when you read the other federal court decisions, you will see is the basis of most of those decisions. The Virginia case is actually a little more rhetorical. The judge in that case got a little carried away. As we're going to have more of those federal court decisions, and especially when you see the appeals courts get in the action, and the hearing on Kitchen in the federal 10th Circuit is going to be April 10th, so 2 weeks from tomorrow, you will see a little more of an emphasis on the more on the grander principles, but they're going to build up from that concrete basis. So thank you very much.
All right. Hello. So I wanted to start by giving just a very brief sketch of the political landscape on this issue now, and this sort of builds on what Dan was saying a moment ago. It appears that there is momentum on the side of legalization, and that's true both nationally in Utah. A New York Times headline 3 days ago read, "Wave of appeals expected to turn the tide on same-sex marriage." And in that article, many legal scholars were quoted predicting a marriage spring in which same-sex marriage proponents win these circuit-level decisions and upend law in many states. And this shift that appears to be happening toward expanding marriage rights is also in sync with changing public opinion on the issue. There's a big study out of UCLA this month that showed that sort of nationally looking at multiple polls over time, They found that the majority of Americans now support same-sex marriage, with more rapid change in support in 2003 than any year before. So what they conclude is both that support is increasing and accelerating. Similarly, in Utah, notwithstanding the op-ed pages of the Deseret News, most legal analysts agree on the weaknesses of the state's case in the upcoming appeal in the Tenth Circuit, and there's growing coalitions around the state, including most recently the explicitly bipartisan group Utah Unites for Marriage, which was just formed to advocate marriage equality here. So let's suppose that gay marriage is coming, and it's not a matter of if, but when. I want to suggest that the political question we need to ask is then what? And that's going to be the focus of my comments today. Achieving equal marriage rights is an important goal. It's an essential part of recognizing gay and lesbian Americans as equal citizens and full persons. And as Beth Talk pointed out, it can alleviate real harms that are suffered by families who lack state recognition. But the premise of my comments today is that the right to marry shouldn't be mistaken for the achievement of full equality. In fact, we should adopt a counterintuitive perspective which regards the legalization of same-sex marriage as a starting point rather than a finish line. So I want to ask, supposing gay marriage is legal, what comes next? More specifically, what comes next if one is concerned, in the words of Judith Butler, with making lives more livable for everyone? So I want to issue sort of three provocations along those lines. One, many basic rights and protections for LGBT citizens are not guaranteed by marriage. This is pretty clear. Other legal protections are badly needed. So housing and employment discrimination, for example, are untouched by marriage laws. And this is really important to remember in the current political climate, where I think there's a tendency to mistake marriage equality for civil equality as such. So the state of Utah does not prohibit discrimination against LGBT people in housing or employment. It's true that 19 municipalities have passed non-discrimination ordinances, but statewide legislation banning employment and housing discrimination against LGBT people has been proposed in the last six legislative sessions and has not passed. So for those who are concerned with equality beyond marriage, agitation and pressure will be necessary. In the most recent legislative session, SB 100 never got out of committee, despite polls showing that the majority of Utahns back this idea. Second provocation, should the state be in the business of granting certain rights and benefits to married couples only? There are material awards the state gives to married couples and to married couples only, but why? Why should we privilege the marital form at all? Why should we distribute benefits on that basis? And I would suggest that a better approach would be two-pronged. On the one hand, to detach certain benefits like healthcare from marriage altogether and make them universal. But second, that those benefits which are relational in nature, like inheritance, medical decision-making, visitation, death benefits, and so on, should be available to a broader range of intimate and kinship relationships, not just those that take the form of legal marriage. And this is really about state recognition of the multiple family forms that already exist, and by the way, are not limited to LGBT people. Many people's lives are intertwined in ways that don't conform to the conventional marriage model. Now, there have been efforts to kind of try to expand the kinds of relationships that are eligible for state benefits, categories like adult designee and reciprocal beneficiaries, but these so far are inadequate, and unfortunately, some of these alternative forms of recognition actually are disappearing as marriage rights are being extended. Tamara Metz, a marriage scholar, has proposed abandoning state-sponsored marriage altogether in favor of intimate union status, a status that would be available to close friends, co-parents, roommates, adult siblings, etc. The idea here is to provide legal protections tailored to support intimate care in all of its forms. Okay, and my third and sort of final provocation. Perhaps we should think about the push for equality in law as part of a broader struggle for substantive and not only formal equality. What do I mean? The mainstream LGBT movement in recent decades has focused on formal legal equality, securing codified rights. But such formal equality, even if important, may be distinct from substantive real equality. Formal legal equality can be achieved while leaving larger structural manifestations of inequality and deep cultural prejudice intact. This is an insight drawn from other minority struggles in the U.S. For example, following the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act, the civil rights leader A. Philip Randolph observed that the movement suffered from, quote, the curse of victory. He worried that equal rights had been achieved in law, but, quote, blacks still were not equal in fact. And queer theorist Lisa Dugan has commented on this history as well, saying that the history of civil rights struggles in the U.S. shows us that formal legal equality does not on its own provide more resources, greater political power, or better lives for members of marginalized groups. And so my claim here is similar. Meaningful equality requires a queer agenda that addresses race, class, and gender stratifications at their roots, not as an add-on to so-called gay issues, but as an integral part of the struggle for real equality. And just one example of what this might mean, an LGBT movement committed to substantive and not only formal equality must pay more attention to economic justice. Irvashi Vaid, the scholar and activist, has noted that equality, as it's now articulated in the mainstream LGBT movement, has been mostly emptied of any of its redistributive content. The call for equality today conforms to liberal capitalism rather than offering a critique of that system and the suffering it perpetuates. And this inattention to material inequality is especially unfortunate because it ignores the economic problems that many queers face. Contrary to the myth of affluence, most gay people are not rich. Substantial scholarly research, if any of you are interested in it, I can point you to it, shows that gay men are just as likely to be poor as straight men, and lesbians are significantly more likely to be poor than straight women. Moreover, LGBT households with kids have poverty rates 2 times those of straight households. And like people of color more generally, LGBT people of color are more likely to live in poverty than their white counterparts. Transgender people are especially economically vulnerable. 1 in 5 trans people has been homeless in their lives. So, an emancipatory politics guided by the principle, no queer left behind, must take economic justice seriously. So, in conclusion, broadening the queer political agenda to include structural forms of oppression can seem daunting. But first, it might be strategically useful. Some issues, like affordable quality healthcare, publicly funded childcare, and a living wage, matter to queers and to a majority of other Americans. So taking on those pressing concerns as queer issues might foster overlapping alliances that could change many lives for the better. And even more important than this strategic issue, the push for substantive equality is what justice requires. The legal advances achieved by LGBT movements run the risk of re-entrenching racial, gender, and class hierarchies unless legal strategies are paired with more demanding labor directed at social transformation. As hard as it is to do, if we tune out the loud debate over marriage, at least for a moment, we might be able to think more creatively and also more ambitiously about the society we want to live in. What does it mean to affirm the dignity of all human beings? More practically, how can we improve the life chances of those currently on the periphery of the social order? How do we make our world more livable? Thank you.
I know you just applauded, but I want to thank all of our panelists for giving those talks. They were really amazing. So can we do it one more time for all three? Thank you. Okay, we're now going to open this up for Q&A. Emily's going to walk around with the... Oh, yeah. Okay. So Emily's going to walk around with the microphone. And before you ask your question, could you please state your name and your major? And if it's directed at a specific panelist, please identify who that is, or we'll go from there.
Hi, my name is Brianna Kirkbride. I'm a political science and history major. And I know you spoke about, I'm sorry, I forget your name, about how legalizing marriage is just one step. Do you believe that legalizing it through the courts might cause lawmakers who did oppose same-sex marriage to not want to go forward with making discrimination against homosexuals illegal?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, that certainly seemed to be the case recently in Utah, right? That was the explicit stance of lawmakers, right? Was that so long as this gay marriage issue was sort of up in the air, there was not going to be any real hearing of the anti-discrimination bill. So I wouldn't want to speculate, you know, whether that would be a more widespread phenomenon. But I would say that once, I mean, I guess my sense would be that if marriage rights end up being fully established, it becomes more untenable to deny those discrimination protections. But that's just my wager.
Hi, my name is Kevin Huang. I'm studying political science here. And my question is, why do gay rights not receive the same holdings of Loving versus Virginia or Heart of Atlanta versus U.S.? Is it just that it's like a newer topic, or because I feel like, you know, being gay and being black fall under kind of the same category? I don't know.
Yeah, that, I think that one's probably for me at this point.
I can do it too. Go for it.
Well, for Heart of Atlanta versus U.S., that's really about commerce, and so it's simply a different question entirely. That was about what kinds of commercial enterprises Congress could regulate. In terms of the Loving case, it really is a different history and an older history. Loving is being applied now in these cases as really the most directly relevant Supreme Court precedent other than Windsor. So it is a much more recent history. And, of course, you really don't see many previous claims. Now, the case that has to be gotten around, if you would, in these same-sex marriage rulings that first brings up the question of same-sex marriage, but where there's no real continuation from, is a case from 1971, I think it is, 71 or 72, Baker versus Nelson from Minnesota, which was a state Supreme Court ruling in Minnesota that then gets appealed to the Supreme Court, which simply found that there was no federal question. The Baker versus Nelson case in Minnesota actually brought up Loving versus Virginia, and Minnesota's Supreme Court basically said, same-sex marriage, what? What is this thing of which you speak? Found no real, you know, it was such a non-concept for people at that point in time. And it was just not a language people spoke, if you would. And so the Supreme Court, which has a discretionary docket, they can decide what they do and don't want to hear, simply says, we don't see a federal rights issue. I hope that's a useful answer to you.
I also want to swing at that. So, and another way to think about this is the history of civil rights law in the U.S. And the Civil Rights Act of 1964 does not include sexual orientation as a protected category, right? It includes race. Interestingly, sex, which as a historian appeared to be a joke of some kind and or an attempt to stop the Civil Rights Act. Yeah. So a segregationist congressman from Virginia who had actually been a supporter of white women's rights but was also a supporter of racial segregation, sure, put sex into the law. And it is kind of assumed that he did so as a way of trying to get it defeated and also to ridicule the Civil Rights Act. I mean, to basically say, you know, extending civil rights to African Americans is as silly as extending them to women. The movement, particularly in the wake of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, had so much momentum, and also we need to give Johnson credit here because President Johnson was better at moving legislation than I think any recent president ever was. Among other things, he did a lot of close talking, which as a big Texan, So there's that. But so it doesn't include sexual orientation. And as a result, sexual orientation doesn't have federal protection. And when there are allegations of discrimination, the federal government looks at that and it does not see those protections in the law, although there are ways around that, particularly through the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. There have been arguments that have been made that are sort of advancing the rights of LGBT people, but the barrier to that comparison, right, is that people of color have different standing before the law in terms of whether or not other people or other institutions or states are allowed to discriminate against them. Take it away, Dan.
Okay. The other thing I just want to follow off on that is the first same-sex marriage cases. The reason we use the phrase same-sex marriage actually comes from those claims being made on the basis of not sexual orientation, but the classification being based simply on sex, as in gender identity. And in the Hawaii cases, the Bear v. Lewin case and Bear v. Mikey case, they sue to say that you're discriminating against me not because it's about who I prefer to have sexual relations with, but simply the sex of the spouse who I choose. That I should be able to choose, if I'm in category A, I should also be able to choose somebody from category A versus category B, and not the question of orientation at all. And they try to take all the sort of icky sexual stuff out of it and make it solely about sex as simply a classification.
Mm-hmm. Right, so in the Civil Rights Act, you're not allowed to discriminate on the basis of sex, although the scrutiny that the court applies to that is actually lower than the scrutiny it applies to race. So there are more protections against discrimination based on race than sex. The state sees legitimate state interest, although decreasingly, in making distinctions between men and women. And so the bar for that is lower, but Dan's absolutely right. These same-sex marriage cases, initially at least, were actually about framed in terms of sex discrimination, that you cannot discriminate on the basis of sex before the law, and as a result, not allowing me to marry my same-sex partner is sexual discrimination rather than discrimination on the basis of sexuality. Does that help a little bit? Yeah.
Okay, this is a next question. A question for the panel. All panelists.
And what's your major?
Perry Schwartz-Shea in the Political Science Department. So just prior to the Shelby decision, there was the decision to, correct me if I'm not characterizing this correctly, decriminalize polygamy. And there wasn't much attention to that decision. Ella has mentioned the article by Tamara Metz, which I haven't read, by Intimate Relationships, about intimate relationships and trying to rethink that way to organize care in a legal system. So my question is thinking about how those ideas intersect with the historical practice of polygamy in Utah, which has certainly not been one of equal dignity for women.
Mm-hmm. You're sighing.
I am sighing.
Why don't you start?
You open the door.
I mean, so if I understand you correctly, you're asking about sort of whether you think the... first of all, what do you think there's a relationship between the push for marriage equality, which is, you know, understood as same-sex marriage equality? Is there a connection between that and the decriminalization of polygamy, at least in terms of the arguments that might be mounted in either instance? I mean, I think my short answer is yes. I mean, I think to the degree that that we're opening up a conversation about what are the forms of intimate relations, and particularly those that understood as the fundamental right, that includes the fundamental right to marry, and how should that right be extended? I mean, I think it's hard to then ignore the way in which that question might be brought to the practice of polygamy. Of course, as your question acknowledges, there's many concerns with the degree to which we can characterize at least certain forms of polygamous relationship as relationships between freely consenting adults. And that it seems like that question is not, that is a separate question that has to be thought through carefully. But, I mean, did you have a more specific question about the decriminalization part of it?
Well, it's just that this was the area in which we had the most intense debate in...
In the gender and politics classes, we had intense debates over whether polygamy could provide equal dignity for women, right? Mm-hmm. So it seems like the move...
Whether it does or whether it ever could.
Whether it ever could, right? So the, the, you know, the move towards same-sex marriage still envisions a partnership between two individuals of equal worth. So,
well, it's no coincidence that when the Mormon Church was pushing Prop 8, I mean, their slogan was one man, one woman, which is a very specific effort not only to push for straight marriage, but to push for non-polygamous marriage. I mean, right. Nobody seems to ever stress the one part of that, but it's actually a very obvious effort to disavow that polygamous history. Right,
right. And I was arguing with some of my students that polygamy on its face... and perhaps polyandry does not mean equal dignity for the ones that are, you know, three or four or five individuals. So does Tamara Metz's article, for example, take up those kinds of issues, or are they abstracted from the history of polygamy both in Utah and across the world?
I can't answer the Tamara Metz question, but I mean, the other thing is that I do think that these two issues are linked, although not, I think, except here, in the minds of the LGBT movement, right? So there's a way in which polygamy activists are piggybacking on the opening up of a conversation about what marriage actually means and what the state's interest is in regulating marriage in particular ways. Now, here's the thing, which is to say the LGBT people had no... That was not on the agenda. It was not something anybody was interested in. But, you know, seeing that opening, I think legitimately polygamous activists were interested in opening up this question. And I think in some ways they were right to do so, right? Because it is a moment when the state is debating what marriage should be and whether the state should regulate it. I also think, and I think that they're right, that changing those definitions is an opening. It seems to me that some of the more grave abuses of polygamous practice are already... illegal, right? You're not allowed to marry children. You're not allowed to force people to get married. You're not allowed to coerce, right? So the question that you're not allowed to milk the beast or whatever it's called, right, where you apply for, oh, that's the welfare benefit thing, where people in polygamous families, second, third, fourth wife, apply for benefits as if they are single parents, right? And so, you know, all of these issues, I think, are interestingly in play, but also are covered by current law if that law was to be enforced. Now, it is true that that law is difficult to enforce. It's also true that there is a world in which we could imagine, although it's perhaps hard, polygamy outside the context of patriarchal religion, which is to say the fact that polygamy in Utah has included all of these abuses that many of us find very problematic does not mean that polygamy itself per se produces unequal relationships in general. Right, I mean, it's hard to see polygamy outside of a patriarchal context because that's where it's always been. It's in a patriarchal context when it was practiced in China. It is in a patriarchal context when it's practiced in a lot of Islamic societies. And it was very much in a patriarchal context locally.
Right.
And so that, I think, is an interesting thing to think about. But I think they do have a point that we've opened up a can of worms here and we don't know where we want to draw those lines and that needs to be thought out. And people who are involved in polygamy need to make their case, which, given the abuses of polygamy, is going to be hard. Because you don't just have people saying, oh, polygamy, it's yucky and weird, and it, you know, is associated with weird, yucky religions that possibly are, you know, in the case of Islam, not white or whatever, right? All of these things that Americans freak out about, right? They need to reach that bar of arguing that there will not be harm in those relationships, because harm has been a very important part of this recent debate in Kitchen, and actually in Windsor as well, right, which is to say... the sides have mobilized ideas about harm in interesting and often, to me, very disingenuous ways. Like, what is harm, and what harm does the state either, you know, prevent or intervene in?
If I may interrupt before you respond, sorry, no. Professor Levin, I just want everyone to know that the KUUER, there it is, recording is about to end, and so I have to say that. So the recording is over, but we encourage you to stay and ask more questions because we have more responses and more questions. So the recording is over, but please stay. We have a lot more to talk about. So continue.
Well, great. Now we can really let it rip.
Yeah, exactly. Now we can say whatever we want.
I'm off the record.
So
anyway.
I did want to interject one part of this, which is we've been talking about marriage largely in terms of benefits and privileges, largely in terms of financial considerations. The real key to, I think, the decriminalization with polygamy is we've decriminalized a lot of what had previously structured marriage, which is marriage was accompanied by a number of criminal laws, which are no longer enforced. Adultery, which in some states, including Utah, is still on the books as a criminal prohibition, no longer is enforced. Either that means everybody has suddenly found, you know, fidelity as their guiding principle, or we've just simply decided we're not going to enforce it. Cohabitation in many states is still a criminal statute. But I doubt that that cohabitation has ceased. In fact, I'm pretty sure it's increased. It was such that we no longer comment on it. And that was actually at the heart of the court's decision, was that it is such selective enforcement that it had become essentially a due process violation to enforce it against certain polygamists. And that's really where all of that has gone.
All right, let's move on to our next question, please.
Hi, I'm Kyler Bowers. I'm in political science, sociology, and gender studies. And I guess this is off.
It's on, recording. We're just not listening.
You can all hear me anyway.
All
right. I wanted to kind of speak to this kind of paradox that went on in the courts after the Prop 8 case. A week later they ruled on striking down a key provision in the Voting Rights Act. And I kind of wanted to, you know, get some insight on whether, you know, the LGBT movement can kind of continue to get gains while the civil rights movement loses.
That appears to be the trajectory.
I have a little something to say in response to that. I mean, there has been some interesting analysis. I'm sure there's been more interesting analysis than what I'm aware of. But there is some coming out of sort of the queer movement that points out that what's kind of consistent in those decisions, particularly in, like, the recent Supreme Court decisions, because there was this response of sort of saying, like, well, how in one breath could the Supreme Court seem, you know, strike down DOMA and then in the next, you know, remove these protections provided by the Voting Rights Act? And one sort of perspective on that is that those